Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. The SAG-AFTRA Foundation believes that contributions made to our culture by performing arts are not only valuable, but also essential. And so we provide free programming and services like this podcast to support them. If you'd like to learn more about the SAG-AFTRA Foundation or access the full library of our conversations or make a donation to support this podcast, please visit sagaftra.foundation. That's www.sagaftra.foundation. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA-Found. Thanks, and enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon. How excited are you? We have Tony Goldwyn today. Thank you, Melissa, and good afternoon. My guest, Tony Goldwyn, is not only one of the greatest actors of his generation, but he is one of the most in-demand directors and producers. He continues to juggle multiple projects both behind and in front of the camera. He is known from such films as Ghost, The Pelican Brief, The Last Samurai, Disney's Tarzan, Kiss the Girls, and Nixon, to name just a few. On stage, he has starred in The Sum of Us, Spike Heels, The Water's Edge, The Dying Gaul, Holiday with Laura Linney, and the musical Promises, Promises, co-starring with Kristen Chenoweth and Sean Hayes. On television, he is known to millions of fans for his role of President Fitzgerald Grant on the hit Shonda Rhimes series Scandal. Scandal fans? Which recently finished up its seven-season run. Right? Seven seasons. He co-created and executive produced the legal drama series The Divide, and he starred in the Lifetime movie Outlaw Prophet Warren Jeffs. Other TV includes The Good Wife, Dexter, Law & Order Criminal Intent, The L Word, Frasier, Truman, Designing Women, and Murphy Brown. It goes on and on. Recent films include Mark Felt, The Man Who Brought Down the White House, co-starring with Liam Neeson and Diane Lane, All I Wish, opposite Sharon Stone, The Belko Experiment with John Gallagher Jr., and both, is it Divergent and Insurgent? Beautiful. I'm just kidding. He has directed such films as Conviction, The Last Kiss, Someone Like You, and A Walk on the Moon. Go right ahead. You know, I was putting this together, I'm like, I can't get all this on paper. There are so many wonderful things he's worked on. Tony also dedicates much of his personal time to philanthropic work. He is an ambassador for Stand Up to Cancer, a board member for AmeriCares, a trustee of Second Stage Theater, and so many others. He has just wrapped production on the new Netflix series Chambers, starring with Uma Thurman, due in spring of 2019. And now he is back on Broadway, sharing the stage with Bryan Cranston and Tatiana Maslany in director Ivo Van Hove's stunning production of Network. Please welcome Tony Goldwyn.
Hi, everyone.
Welcome.
Thanks, Richie. Thank you.
You know, when I went through your list, it goes on and on. What a career you've had and have.
Well, I'm not a young man, Richard.
No, you are. Of course you are. Well, first off, welcome back to Broadway. How does it feel?
It feels like coming home.
Yeah.
It really does. It's been, you mentioned Promises, Promises, yeah. Which I did right before Scandal, and that was 8 years ago. Wow. So I haven't done a play since, so it's really a beautiful thing, and to be back in such an extraordinary production as the one we're doing now, it's what I dreamed about doing when I was starting out, wondering if anyone would ever give me a job.
Yeah.
So that the fact that I can walk to work through Central Park and go into the theater is pretty magical.
Yeah. And what a way to return. I mean, for those of you who have seen the show and for those of you who haven't, you must see Network. This production is absolutely stunning in every fashion of how it's done. Mm. I mean, when you were first approached about doing this, like you're working with Ivo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just explain what the look of the show and the feel.
Well, for those of you that know the movie Network, It was made in 1976. Sidney Lumet directed it, and Paddy Chayefsky wrote it. And it was Chayefsky was writing sort of a dystopian satire about where he saw our media culture going. And everything he said has come true, and then a lot more. So Ivo wanted to do, you know, he felt he wanted to do this screenplay as a piece of theater. And so what he's done is, it's still set in 76, but it feels very contemporary, and cameras and screens and multimedia are a very important part of the show. So there are literally cameras on stage, there are projections everywhere. We literally do a scene, you know, sort of reality TV is kind of part of the experience, and Tatiana and I do a scene out on the street live every night on 44th Street, and then walk right on stage and do another scene. And that's just projected on this giant screen that the audience is watching, and no one believes that we're doing it live. They're like, no, but you guys filmed that ahead of time. So it's very, very unusual. It's kind of almost like a piece of performance art.
Yeah.
That you're sort of dropped into this world that Ivo and his longtime life partner and theatrical designer, Jan Ver, I can't pronounce his last name, Ver.
That's why I was going to let you do it.
Has created this environment that's just extraordinary. I mean, as an actor, it's like being dropped in a fishbowl. You know, like those fishbowls with all the castles and things, and you go, oh, that must be cool to be a fish, and you're like in your little universe. That's what it feels like to be in network every night.
Because it's so theatrical and filmatic and everything.
Yeah, and there's a restaurant on stage.
Yeah.
Because there's a restaurant scene, a very unusual restaurant scene, and involving me and Tatiana. And so Ivo was like, well, why don't we just have a restaurant on stage and make it real? So there are people having dinner and being served alcohol throughout the play, and we enter. Brian and I do a scene at the bar that, you know, is our first scene together, and it kind of opens the show. And you know, we're actually in the wings of the theater where the bar is, and there's people behind the bar eating and drinking that are closer than you are to me, and yet it's projected to the entire 1,000-seat Belasco Theater while we're doing it with a camera right in our face. It's very unusual.
But I also like when you walk into the theater at half hour, you're all in the makeup chairs getting ready. I mean, they're in the newsroom getting everything set.
Yeah.
That's got to be, is it exciting for you as an
actor? I don't like it.
Okay.
Brian and I both feel it. Ivo wanted all the actors to come out on stage and do our warm-ups like on stage as the people are eating their dinner and as the audience is coming into the theater and to talk to people. And I don't have that kind of concentration. I got to get my shit together before I go on stage. So, but I kind of, without, except for me and Brian, Tatiana goes right out there and does yoga and like, and Frank Wood, the brilliant actor, Frank Wood, it's funny, it's warm up. He goes on, he plays imaginary tennis on stage. He's like, I don't know if that's some acting exercise or he's like, there's like archery. I don't know what he's doing. But people do these warm ups. So they do, Henry Stram goes out and does a headstand for 10 minutes every night. And then Nick Wyman, who is brilliant in the show, Nick goes and just kind of chats up whoever's in the in the restaurant and has long talks with them every night. And then we come out and the makeup stations are on, it's in the wings kind of, but so that we do, I get our hair and makeup kind of fixed up. But and then periodically Nick or somebody will bring a fan over to take a selfie, which is fine.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I find it very weird. I can't, maybe I'll relax into it, but I don't know.
No, but I watched you the other night. You were like at the makeup chair, getting ready or whatever. So do you like to arrive to the theater early?
I have.
Okay.
For this show, I always do a bit.
Yeah.
But I find this show's very, very challenging. Yeah. I could not possibly just show up at half hour and then go do the show. It's very challenging vocally, as you can probably hear, my voice is a little tired. And I don't know, something, I don't know what it, I don't know why. Chayefsky's language, it's very intense energy-wise. It's almost like, I feel like, maybe I said this, it's like doing a musical.
Yeah.
Because Ivo has orchestrated everything. There's so much happening all at the same time, and it's like, it does not. It's like getting on a roller coaster for 2 hours. So this show, I need to be there at least an hour ahead. Sometimes I feel like at two. It just depends. We'll see as we get into the run, but we just opened last week, so. Yeah.
Talk about who you play.
So I play Max Schumacher. For those of you who don't know the movie, for those of you that do, William Holden played him in the movie. For those of you that don't, the film is about a television network that is struggling in the ratings, and particularly their news division is struggling in the ratings, and they've recently been taken over by a giant corporation. And at the beginning of the show, I am the head of the news division, longtime head of the news division of this network. And Howard Beale, who Brian plays, is our longtime news anchor, and it's sort of a legend in television news, a la kind of, you know, Walter Cronkite-ish, or, you know, maybe not quite. He maybe was just a little under Cronkite, if Cronkite was the man. But we all came up together in that way. And Howard's gone through some very difficult times recently, and I ended up having to fire him at the beginning of the, you know, at the beginning of the show, because he's getting such low ratings, and he's been depressed and having a hard time. And Howard goes on the air after being fired and says, I'm announcing my retirement, and a week from tonight, I will kill myself on live television. So I just want to let you guys know. So you can tune in, and we'll get great ratings. And it sets off a firestorm, and the ratings go insane. And this corporation, the corporate interests feel they have a tiger by the tail, and they exploit this man who is in fact losing his mind. And I'm trying to hold the line on journalistic integrity unsuccessfully. And to protect, maybe more importantly, protect my best friend from being eaten by the wolves. And I don't do a very good job.
What's it like sharing the stage with Bryan Cranston?
Well, I guess it's like, you know, playing tennis with Roger Nadal or something, you know, Roger Federer or something, or playing with a great tennis player. You know, you just have to bring your A game, and he hits the ball hard, you know. But it's thrilling and fun. And, you know, for those of you that know Brian, you know, he's just the sweetest, kindest, most down-to-earth human being. So it's easy, but it's challenging at the same time. You know, I find myself sort of in awe of him as a performer, because he's what he does in this show. I really recommend you guys see it. It's kind of a monumental performance, and it's like King Lear or something. What he's doing, you know, it's very taxing, and he just gives 150% every performance. I never have seen him hold back, ever. And I've never worked with anyone like that before. I mean, you know, even the great Kristen Chenoweth, when we were doing Promises, Promises, you know, Kristen had to hold, like, there were performances where she just held back on her vocally a little bit, because it was just, it's just so hard doing Broadway, you know. And Brian swings the bat as hard as he can every show. It's amazing.
And then there's Tatiana, like.
Yeah, and Tatiana's also so wonderful. Different, because this is only her second play. Yeah. She's this incredibly gifted actress. And I remember seeing Orphan Black and going, who the hell is that? Like, what did I just see? The work that she did, even in that pilot, I was like, I couldn't believe it. And she brings, and she's also just a natural theater actress. But she did a play at Second Stage last summer, Mary Page Marlowe, and that was her first time on stage. And she doesn't show it, but she's, what is Tatiana like? Tatiana's like, she's just game. Yeah. You know, it's that thing, she's so fun to act with, because she's just completely open and like, let's see what happens. You know, completely relaxed and down for anything, and super excited all the time to see what's up and what we could do tonight. Again, deeply humble, which is, to me, is the mark of all good actors. And that kind of student mind, you know, like she's just always feels like she's making it up as she goes along. So it's really thrilling to, and I do a lot with her. I mean, I guess I do a lot with everybody, but Brian and I have a very specific and special relationship in the show, and Tatiana and I do as well. They're complex, both of them. So we get to, it's a privilege for me. I feel very lucky.
So I understand when you work with Evo, you have to be off book first day of rehearsal.
Yeah.
Okay, I think you answered part of my question when you're,
yeah.
Were you good at that before?
I had never tried it before.
I'm
very familiar with it because in television and film, you have to be off book, but you only have to do like one or two scenes a day.
Yeah.
So it's different. it was a challenge on Scandal, frankly. You know, Shonda writes very theatrical dialogue, and sometimes we'd have like, you know, a three-page monologue that you might not have so much time to prepare. So you get quite good at memorization. I noticed when I did Promises, Promises, that Sean Hayes showed up to the first day of rehearsal completely memorized. Because he'd done Will and Grace for so years, that was also how he knew how to work it. I don't think Sean had ever done a play before. And he was absolutely brilliant. And if people didn't see that, he was amazing in that production. And he carried the show, you know, as Jack Lemmon carried the movie The Apartment. You know, Sean carried the play. And I remembered thinking, I was very impressed like at how free Sean was because he wasn't holding a script. And the rest of us were holding our books for a couple of weeks until we got off book and kind of finding our way into it. And he was just like, let's go. So I had thought about it. I thought, well, maybe the next play I'll do, maybe I'll try that, because that was pretty interesting. Then I got an email from Brian asking me to do this part, because we were friends and we had worked together 20 years ago, is how we met. And in the email, he's like, I just need you to know, Eva wants everybody off book at the first rehearsal. I loved it.
Yeah.
It was great. I'm always going to do it from now on because the only other, I've heard Mark Rylance expects that of his actors when they do Shakespeare, like the Globe. Apparently he insists on that, but it completely frees you up. It gets you out of your head into your body fast. You know that, I don't know, the older I get and the longer I do this, the less interested I am in talking about stuff. We all just talk too much. Like the idea of sitting on a table for a week and let's talk about this scene. And I, as a young actor, I loved talking about it. It was so awesome and I had so many opinions. And even as an old actor, I mean, I want to talk about the biography that I wrote for my character because I worked so damn hard on it. I wanted to share it with somebody and, well, I think this, you know? And people are like, wow, that's really interesting. And that's so smart. And I'd be like, yeah, it's pretty smart, isn't it? Then I'd go, that wasn't terribly useful to me. Like, I talked that out, and now I got to do it, and it's not helping me at all. Like, that clever idea is not so helpful. So the way Evo works is you don't talk at all.
Yeah.
Like, Brian warned me, like, you just need to know he doesn't like to talk. And we had... He has this amazing assistant director, Danny Raggett, who's 28 years old, brilliant English kid. And he gives Dan tremendous responsibility. And before rehearsal, we had to have a Skype call with Danny for an hour. And I was like, what? He said, I just needed to talk to you about how Evo works. And I was kind of intimidated. I thought, because I'd seen his Evo's work, and I was like the great Evo Van Hove. And he's like, he doesn't talk. It's like, okay. He's very shy, he's very Dutch, although he's actually Belgian, you know, but he lives in Amsterdam, has this Dutch theater company, and Danny was like, you know, he said a lot of the English actors, when we did this at the National, were very sort of put off because actors love to tell stories, and a lot of these actors wanted to tell stories when they were at the RSC, and they did this, that, and the other thing, and Eva would be like, yes, okay, anyway, now we move on. And he was just like, interrupt people. So I kind of... was ready and looking forward to not talking, actually, because of what I said before. But I was kind of nervous because I thought what I would get is someone who was kind of cold and mean, you know? And it's the opposite. He's the sweetest, most gentle, open kind of, what's the word? Again, humble.
Yeah.
Creative presence. But he just does not waste time. Yeah. So you get up and you begin. There's no chit-chat. Rehearsal starts and you work. Yeah. It's not like harsh, but he doesn't say good morning unless he sees you or you bump into him. He's like, good morning, gives you a hug. But it's not like, hey, everybody, let's all say hi. It's just like everyone's there, all the designers, everybody is at every single rehearsal. We start with the cameras and all the technical aspects. Every music cue and sound cue is at the first rehearsal, which is very unusual, as you know. There's no discussion about anything. You just get up and we do one table read, and then we start working. And it was fantastic. Yeah. You just didn't have time to think about anything.
That's great.
Yeah, it was really thrilling.
Yeah. No, if you say hello to everybody, you've wasted 45 minutes of your rehearsal time.
And also, he only likes to rehearse 5 hours a day. And we only rehearsed for 3.5 weeks, where normally it's a five-week process where you rehearse 8 hours a day. And one Saturday, he was like, we don't rehearse on Saturday. We take the day off. I was like, what? What? We didn't. So we rehearsed 5 days that week instead of six. He's like, no, it's good. We don't need to. So we were all terribly nervous. And Brian, who'd done it in London, was like, don't worry. It'll all come together. But he does not waste any time, so the work all gets done. By the time, you know, so we spent 2 weeks in the rehearsal room, then we were in the theater, teching. We never ran through the show, not once. And the techs, because everything was built together, our tech rehearsals were actually rehearsals. Because normally, as you know, when we do a tech rehearsal, by the time you get into the theater, then it's like stop and start and cue to cue, and you can't really act because it's really, for now, all the technical people need their time. But because they'd all been involved, we were able to play the scenes, and sometimes we have to go back and adjust a cue, but they were quite useful rehearsals. And then our first run-through of the whole show was 2 days before we had an audience. We'd never been through the play from start to finish. So we did two run-throughs. We did a run-through, and then the next day we did an invited dress, and then the next day we did our first preview. That was it. But it kind of worked. I mean, it was a little bit like, oh, shit, we're doing this, but it was amazing. It really did. And then we had a month of previews to kind of find and rehearse and refine things before we open. So it was a very exciting process.
It's such a huge show, but it's a well-oiled machine. The whole thing plays beautifully.
And I forget, did you see it opening night or did you come earlier?
The night before.
The night before, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Just great. Yeah. You know, the play has been adapted by Lee Hall from Pat H. Chayefsky's Academy Award-winning screenplay. Mm-hmm. It must be so great to say those words.
Mm-hmm.
What a beautiful, beautiful
really
script,
is. And
right?
Lee did such an incredible job because it's so faithful to Patty's screenplay, and yet Lee really brought the way he structured it, and there's additional dialogue where he moved stuff from one scene to another. And Lee, if you don't know, is a great playwright. He wrote both the film and the theatrical adaptation of Billy Elliot, which is one of my favorite movies, and it was so amazing on stage. And God, so many other things. He did War Horse, right? What else did Lee do? He's just extraordinary. And so, but it's Paddy Chayefsky, you know, I feel very lucky to, and every night, it's one of those plays where every night you hear something different.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's really interesting, which is sort of like doing Shakespeare. You're like, oh, that's what that means. Or, I'd never heard that before, you know, even though you've been hearing it for weeks.
Because there's so much going on that mm-hmm. stage. It's so beautiful.
There is, and it's a very dense screenplay. Yeah. I mean, he's got a lot to say about America and television and politics and
so ahead
money.
Of its time.
Yeah.
Like you said, it was a satire then. Now it's reality today.
Well, that's what Ivo said in our first rehearsal. He said, you know, in 76, this was a satire, and it's not a satire anymore. It's very real.
Yeah. I want to go back to the beginning. You grew up in one of the most famous and prominent Hollywood families. So where did your love for performing begin, and what were your earliest creative outlets?
Well, yeah, my family was, my grandfather was one of the founders of the movie business on my father's side. But on my mother's side, my grandfather was a Broadway playwright and screenwriter named Sidney Howard. And my mother had been an actress pretty much up until I was born, and then she stopped and became a painter. But she, her whole world was the New York theater, and that was kind of my indoctrination. To me, that's what I fell in love with. I sort of didn't have any interest in the movies. But when I went to the theater at 4 years old, I was like, oh, what is that? You know, and a lot of my, I never knew any movie stars growing up because my parents were determined that we wouldn't become Hollywood brats. So I was never allowed on a set. I never knew a celebrity, not one. But I knew a lot of actors who were my parents' close friends who were actors in the theater or just working actors. So that to me was where the romance was in it. And as a performer, I guess I didn't think I wanted to do something other than the business because Goldwyn was kind of having a famous last name can be kind of oppressive, you know, and you just get sick of talking about it and you want to be your own person. So, but I started to enjoy, I realized I loved performing in elementary school, you know, and then it was like in choir in middle school. And then in high school, I decided to audition for the school play in ninth grade because my older brother was kind of he was in the theater department, did all the plays and was kind of the lead actor. John was 2 years older than me. And yeah. It was Inherit the Wind. And he was playing Henry Drummond, right? Isn't that the character's name? The Clarence Darrow character. Yeah. And so I was like, okay, I'll go read for it. And so I read for a small part and didn't get cast. But I got a one-line part, but I didn't get the part I wanted. And then, but I remember vividly this experience of sitting with the drama teacher and opening this book and reading this audition. And I was just like, oh, I know how to do this. It was so thrilling. I'd never felt that before. I was so thrilling. I'd never felt that I was any good at anything. And I was 14 and had the insecurities that most 14-year-olds have. And it was like being shot up with adrenaline. It was the weirdest thing. Yeah, and then I didn't get the part. Little did I know how much that would tell me about being an actor. But I did my one line and that was exciting. And yeah, so that was kind of how and then eventually I started getting, you know, better parts.
Better parts.
Yeah.
Was there a defining moment for you when you said, I can now do this as a business? Like, I'm really going to go for this.
I'm still waiting.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. No, yeah. What was it? There were a few, you know, because you have that and then you get disappointed and you think, oh, I was wrong. So I had a lot of it. You know, like I sort of became in high school after that and being like getting crappy parts for a couple of years. By the time I was a senior, I was like the lead. I was like head of the theater department and, you know, like playing the lead roles. And I was like, I'm pretty hot shit. And I go to college and I got cast in the lead role in the first play I auditioned for at the little college in upstate New York that I went to. And all of the older students hated me. It was Sam Shepard's Tooth of Crime. And I got cast as Crow, which is so weird. Yeah. And there were all these seniors. I think they were seniors or juniors who like thought they should have been cast. And they were so mean to me. One of them, I won't name his name, is a wonderful actor who's still working today. And I'm have a lot of respect for him, but he was so mean to me. And he played a smaller part, you know, but I did Tooth of Crime and I was like, again, I'm pretty hot shit, you know. Then I transferred after a couple of years at Hamilton where I was to Brandeis because I'd heard had this very serious theater department. I was just like, I'm in upstate New York. I don't know how I figure out being an actor. And so I went to Brandeis and could not get cast in anything. I showed up, at Hamilton, I was pretty like, but it was a tiny school. Yeah. And I got to Brandeis had this big theater and a graduate program and all this stuff. And I went in and auditioned for, I must have auditioned for 15 plays and didn't get called back to one. And they were like, no one, it was like, you just feel they dismissed it. And I was went in acting class, and the teacher who to this day is the best acting teacher I've ever had, who eventually, you know, thought better of me, but at first I just could not do anything right in his class, and he was so mean to me, and I was just like, oh my God, what do I do? And I was 20 at that point. I was a junior, decided this is what I'm doing with my life, and I was failing.
Yeah.
And then so I said, well, I guess I'm not getting any. The only part I got, it was a student production my junior year of Company. It was the worst production of Company that has ever been mounted in the United States of America. And I.
What'd you play?
Oh, I did not play Bobby. I played Paul, okay. The husband. Yeah. So I had, I don't even think I had a song. I think I had a couple of lines. And I'm kind of wrong for Paul, but I played Paul. And it was embarrassing. Oh my God, it was so bad. It was kind of fun, but it was terrible. So I didn't know what to do. So I went and I looked in the local Boston papers to see if there was, if I could get an audition or something. And God said, well, you're not going to cast me here. Let me see if I can get something away from school. And there was this place called the Boston Shakespeare Company, which was a semi-professional theater company. It was like non-equity, but they did shows. In downtown Boston, and they had a kind of nice theater, and they were doing Richard III. So I went and auditioned and I got cast as the Duke of Clarence, which is a very good part. Yeah. And I was like, what? And it was all grown-ups. So, like, I was the youngest person. The other young person that was cast in that show was Courtney B. Vance. Wow. Courtney was at Harvard, and I was at Brandeis, and Courtney was cast as one of the murderers who killed me in the tower, because Clarence gets murdered in the tower after this great speech about this terrible dream he had. So I got cast in this. Okay, so you want to hear something really mean? No. So I thought, cool, I'm in this real show. So I go to the head of the theater department, who was my acting teacher, and I was a theater major, and I wanted to get his permission to let him know, and I didn't want to let him know I was doing this, and this is the guy who had, like, I'd been stinking up his class for 6 months. And I go in and I get a meeting with him. And I say, Ted, you know, I just want to let you know I got cast in this show and I want to make sure that's okay. And I might have to miss class or something here and there. And he said, he was this cranky older guy. And he's like, smoke, they talk like this. Ted Kasnov, he's a truly brilliant teacher. The best I've ever had in my whole career, I swear. But not the nicest. Ultimately, very big-hearted, but not user-friendly. Yeah. You're like, oh, well, I just think you should know why they hired you. I said, what? He goes, well, I just think it's important. I mean, it's great, but you know why they hired you. I said, what? He said, what is your last name? I mean, that's obviously why they hired you, and you should do it. I mean, it's great, but... And you just need to know the reality is that. And I went, maybe, okay. That may be true, but I'm still gonna do it because it's a good opportunity. Yeah, that's great. I was crushed. I was just like, shit, okay, well, all right. Maybe that's true, I don't know. So I went and I did it. And I can't say I was good, but I did okay. And for a 20-year-old kid, you know. And Ted brought my acting class to see the show. Like, they were being supportive, and by that time they sort of got to know me, and they were like, oh, well, let's go see Tony's show. And it was after the show, I remember this look on his face. He was so surprised that I was good, relatively speaking. You know, it was called for a college kid, like I did okay. Yeah. And I just remember this sort of stunned look on his face, like, where did you come from? Like, what? And everyone was like, so at the end of the year, that was all the whole spring. We did it for like 3 or 4 months. The end of the spring, we auditioned for the fall plays for this my senior year. And Ted cast me as Chris in All My Sons, which is the lead in All My Sons, which he was directing on the main stage. You know that. And so then all of a sudden, boom, I was like the hot guy in Brandeis Theater. Which, everything's relative, right? I mean, and that has happened to me over and over and over again in my career. I guess that's like the perfect, this cycle of failure and success has constantly repeated itself again and again and again and again, whether I was like starring in a movie and then, or not, you know, or it's like, that's so, I can't remember if I even answered your question.
Oh, you did. No, this is great.
That cycle is a perfect example of when you think you've made it. And then, you know, like I thought I'd made it when I got cast in my first show in New York. On my first job while I was at Brandeis, I auditioned for the non-equity company at the Williamstown Theater Festival. And I miraculously got cast. And I was, it was that same year. God, that was a good year for me. While I was doing Richard III, I auditioned for Williamstown, thinking that was my dream to go to Williamstown. And I got cast. And I had a connection, because Blythe Danner, who was sort of friends of my family, a friend of a friend of our family, this wonderful actor named Norman Lloyd, and Norman's 104 now. Yeah. And so, but Norman said, you must go to Williamstown, and I'm going to call Blythe and never put in a good word for you. And Blythe did. And so maybe that's why I got cast. I don't know. But I was there. And I thought, oh, that's my big break. But you know, and I ended up getting my equity card at Williamstown, but also spent a lot of months at Williamstown not being cast and convinced that Nikos, who was the artistic director and founder, thought, who could be very tough. Yeah, Nikos was so mean to me, but he gave me everything. So you go through this cycle of up and down.
Because I had many stars here. You know, they say when you read off like all the things that Tony has done, a star told me once, you have to look at the in-between, Richie, of all these jobs where I had nothing. Well, you don't know what's going
to
come.
Yeah, it's you just get used to that. That's the thing, I'm used to it. So I'm like, okay, no one's ever going to give me a job. So what am I going to, I got to make it happen for myself. That's how I became a director, because I was just like, the reason I became a director was because all through my 20s, I struggled and struggled and struggled, and I worked. I started working fairly consistently, but it didn't feel like I had traction because I was always out of work. And then I get a job on a guest star on a TV show, but I'd work for 3 days. And then I wouldn't work for 3 months. And I'd be like, oh my God, this is tough. And then finally I got Ghost, which was a huge break for me and put me I was like, okay, thanks. So again, now I'm on the map. And I was 29 when I did that. And then I had this big hit off Broadway in this beautiful play I did called The Sum of Us that same year. And like I got an Obie Award. And I was like, okay, I did my job. I'm in a hit movie. I'm one of the leads. I've got an Obie Award for this play. I said to my agents, like, make me a star. Like, I did my part. What happens now? Nothing is the answer to that. I auditioned for stuff, and I don't know. It was like then the next movie, I didn't do another movie for a year. Wow. I remember while I was doing The Sum of Us, I got offered this TV movie, or it was a cable movie, in the sort of relatively early days of cable. This was like 1990. It was a TNT movie. It was sort of an interesting movie about the Iran hostage crisis. It was not a very good part. I played Jody Powell, Carter's press secretary. But they offered me $65,000 to do this. And that was more money. That was the same amount of money I got paid to do Ghost. That's how much I got paid to do Ghost. At the time, it seemed like a fortune.
Yeah.
But it was not much money. But to me, I was making whatever I was making off, but I needed the money.
Yeah.
And I was like, and also I wasn't used to being offered work. So I was like, okay, I'll do it, I guess.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to decide, you know? And my agents didn't say, no, we need to like you need to wait and be patient, and we're going to find the right thing for you. And I just didn't know. So I took work because I was an actor, you know. And then the next movie I did, which was a year later, was fun, but it wasn't very good. And then the next one I did was both not fun and not good and did not make money. And all of a sudden, I found 2 years later, I was like, oh, you were that guy who did Ghost. Like, yeah, well, you were hot for a minute. And
yeah.
So suddenly I was getting jobs. So I was very, very grateful for that. And it was making more than $65,000. So that was good. But the good news, I was able to support my family, but I wasn't a star. I was like, people thought I was a good actor and I was getting work regularly enough, but I wanted to be a leading actor, you know, and it wasn't happening. So I thought, God, man, in 10 years, I can't do that. I can't be doing this. I got to figure something else out. So I started, I thought, well, I need to be in, next time I'm in a hit, which is like, only God can decide that. I want to be able to have something that I know I want to do. Like, okay, so now I'm in a hit, now I have leverage, so here's what I want to do. So I thought I'd find scripts for myself to act in, and then that I could then produce. Didn't want to be a director. And then I found a script after looking at hundreds of scripts that I fell in love with. Didn't feel very right to act in it, but I wanted to meet the writer, and she didn't have any other scripts. We started talking about it. I said, well, this is what I think you should do to make this better. And she said, well, would you produce this with me? Because I really love your ideas. And anyway, so I worked for a couple of years on this script, trying to get another director to do it. And I got so invested in it, I didn't want to give it to somebody else. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to direct this myself. And it was sort of by that time I'd realized that there was nothing you can't do. You just have to challenge yourself to do it. I was afraid of directing. I thought, well, who am I to say that I could do something like this? And I was like, I'm going to do it. And so then, like, God did intervene, and suddenly the money fell in my lap, and I got a call saying that Dustin Hoffman had read this script.
Tell them the name of the movie.
So it was A Walk on the Moon.
Great film, one of my favorite movies. Nice.
And I had, you know, I got a call from CAA one day going, yeah. Tony, you know, you have controlled the rights to this project, right? And I was like, yeah, and you want to direct it, right? Yeah. Well, Dustin Hoffman wants to read it. I was like, what? He said, well, someone had read that script years ago, and they told him about it, and he's just started, his company has, like, got a financing deal to make independent movies, and they want to read it. And I was like, I had literally not shown the rewritten script to anybody since I decided to direct it, and I sent it to Dustin's company, and they were like, yep, we want to do it, and you can direct it. I'd been working on it for 4 years at that point. And then I stumbled in and found, as soon as I started directing, I was like, oh, my God, I know how to do this. And that opened up a whole new thing. So my point was, ever since then, I realized, oh, I can't sit around and wait for someone to give me a job. I got to make it happen for myself.
Yeah.
And ever since I've taken that was 20 years ago, and ever since I've taken that attitude towards my career, I've been so much happier and more regularly employed. And it's taken the pressure off of my acting career, because at times when I wasn't getting so much acting work, or at least not getting things that I was excited about, I was like, all right, that's not happening. I'm going to do this.
What was it like those first few days? You said, now I'm going to direct this film. You have your stars, you're on the set. You knew
for Walk on the Moon?
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
The first thing, casting was the hardest. Auditioning actors was the most painful thing for me. I remember I would have actors come in, and I would literally spend an hour with every actor. Yeah. Even if they were completely wrong. I just felt so guilty. I was like, I want this to be a good experience for you. So we'd get so far behind, yeah. You know, like there'd be people waiting in the hallway for, you know, because we had 15-minute appointments scheduled. And I'd be like, would you like to sit here, or would you want this chair or that chair? Where would you like to sit? Where would you feel good? Finally, one guy's like, dude, you just tell me where to sit. I have enough to worry about. I'll sit wherever you want me to sit. I don't really care. I'm like, oh, sorry. So that took some getting used to, where I didn't feel guilty about making people audition. I still feel that way, but I'm over it. So that was one thing. But the main thing that I remember feeling when we went into pre-production, Once we were cast and we were on location, we shot it in Montreal, and I showed up in our production offices, and you start going through all these meetings for what all the designers and the DP and everything, and I was like, it was like putting on clothes that fit. I was like, oh, I know how to do this. Whereas up until then, I was like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I swear. And I'd worked with many first-time directors as an actor, so I knew that the ones that were successful were the ones that surrounded themselves with people who were expert at what they did and were willing to learn from them, as opposed to the ones that failed were the ones that were like, well, it's my movie, and I know what I want, and it's got to be this way, and I want to use this lens. And, you know, those guys crashed. And the ones that often did really well were the ones that said, I know what story I want to tell, but I don't know what I'm doing, so please help me. So that was my philosophy going in. But I did, in fact, know what I was doing, even though I didn't know anything about the camera. I had to tell the DP, you know, you got to tell me, I don't know what shots were. I didn't know, to the script supervisor, I was like, you have to make sure I get coverage, because I didn't even know what coverage was. And I'd been in, God, by that time, I'd probably been in 20 movies. But you just don't know. As an actor, you're not exposed to all of those other aspects.
Well, I want to sort of start, I love to ask stage actors the first time you were on a TV set and a film set.
Oh, that's a good question.
Okay.
That's good.
Oh. Your first film was Jason, right? Was Jason Lives?
Yes.
Friday the 13th, the sixth installment.
Six.
Okay.
Oh, you put that so elegantly.
The sixth installment. And your first TV job was Saying Elsewhere, right? Around the same time?
Yes, which makes me shudder.
No? So tell me what those were like.
Oh, it was awful. Friday the 13th was terrible, but it was fun. My first was, you know, at Williamstown, it's such a wonderful place, and so many actors got their start there. And in the old days, Tom Fontana and Bruce Paltrow, who, God rest his soul, was Blythe Danner's husband and one of the great television producers who created Saying Elsewhere and many others. you know, because Blythe was sort of the leading actress, Bruce would always spend their summers up there, and Gwyneth was a little kid, and Jake, and Tom, when I started at Williamstown, was kind of, he was a playwright who then kind of ran our non-equity company. He was kind of he kept us in line. And Tom now, of course, is one of the greatest television writers in the business. Yeah. But Tom's first job was on Saying Elsewhere. Bruce sort of spotted him and said, you should come work for me. And they started Saying Elsewhere, and then that really launched Tom's career. So over the years, as that show was a hit, by the time I'd spent a couple of years at Williamstown, Bruce and Tom would say to all the actors, when you come to LA, give us a call and we'll give you your SAG card.
Wow.
So, and they made good on it with all of us. So I got to LA after a couple of years, you know, working in New York in the theater and getting some jobs, but realizing I need to break into film and TV. And at that time, in the mid 80s, there wasn't much film and television here, really. It was all in LA. So I went out to LA and I called up Bruce and Tom, and they had me in, and they said, good, we're going to, I didn't even have to audition. They just gave me a pretty nice part, actually. And I was terrified. Oh, God, I still have a stomachache when I think about it. I showed up to work, and I go in to wardrobe, and this was like season 5 or something of Saying Elsewhere. It must have been 4 or 5. And they'd been doing it a while. And my scenes were with Alfre Woodard and maybe Denzel. Yeah. Denzel was still on the show.
Yeah.
And this other actress who played my wife. And the first thing, I show up to work and I go in, and they say, you need to go to the wardrobe trailer. And I go into the wardrobe trailer, and the wardrobe supervisor hands me my costume. And it was a sports jacket and a tie. And I said, is there a different tie? Like, I just feel like maybe I wouldn't wear that kind of tie. And the guy looked at me like, put the fucking tie on. You're gonna wear that tie. And I was like, oh, well, okay. So I put on the tie and I go in to rehearse. And you walk into the set to rehearse the scene, and I'd learned my lines and stuff like that. And it was this scene where I played a young guy with a much older wife, and she's pregnant, and we're in her ultrasound. And the issue of the storyline was that the baby was apparently had a heart defect, potential heart defect, early in the pregnancy. and the wife wants to abort the fetus to, because it sort of was about designer babies. Yeah. If you see what I mean, she wanted to like abort the fetus, and I didn't want her to. I think I can't quite remember, and it was an ethical dilemma that Alfre felt very strongly that we should not. And Denzel basically was saying to Alfre, it's not your call. It's the parents' call. It's not your job. And that was the issue, right? So we're in the ultrasound, and I'm seeing the ultrasound. I'm sitting by my wife, and the doctor, Alfre's doing the thing, and we're excited, and I'm just like trying not to overact. So I'm like, oh, it's great, it's great, it's great. And we go through this rehearsal, and there's three cameras staring at me, and they're like right there, and I'm like, and there's all these people around me, not interested. And I'm like, oh my God, okay, I'm saying my words. And no one speaks to me. No one says hello or anything. And this director, Alan Arkush, who's a wonderful director, but he was not very nice to me, but like Ted Kasner. It seems to be a theme in my life. And so we do the rehearsal, and they block it, and we do it, and we're walking back while they light to go back to my cubicle. And he goes, oh, what's your name, Tom? I said, Tony. He said, Tom, more. I need more from you. And I said, oh, okay, more. He said, just more. You just got to give me more. It's like, okay, got it. Great. Oh, it's horrible. So I do my day of work like this. I just was so tense and stressed out and didn't know what to do with these machines staring at me. And it was horrible. Please don't watch it. I 3 months, whatever, a month later, my best friend and I watched it. Like, I went to his house and it was just terrible. It was so, I was like a block of wood. I've seen it once, and I will never watch it again.
All right. Because I had Vincent D'Onofrio here.
Did Vince say the same thing?
Well, I'll tell you. Oh. The first time
about me?
No.
I mean about himself.
But you played his brother on
I did, yeah, many years later, yes.
Okay.
Went okay.
Because I asked Vincent what it was like being on the set the first day. I said, I was terrible. Because he was looking at all this stuff, and they're like, dude, you're doing way too much. What is this? He knew nothing about, how you work on a set.
Right.
And he was the lead.
Oh, wow. Well,
no, you know what I mean. It's like,
I should be grateful that I was not the lead. Yeah.
So let's get, what was it like working with Vincent?
Oh, Vincent was great. Yeah. I love him. I did that part. I was on an airplane.
Yeah.
And I always admired Vince, but never knew him. And he and I, it was kind of a mutual admiration thing.
Yeah.
And we were talking, and somebody's like, I wonder, there's this character that they're writing of my brother on my show, would you do it? I'd love for you to do it. You'd be so great and we would have fun. And I was like, sure, let's do it. And so I did four episodes. And he was great. I loved him. He was really so fun. He's such a inventive and free and he was great. Really would look forward to working with him again sometime.
Well, let's go into the Pelican brief because you mentioned Denzel Washington and Julia Roberts. Did Denzel, we know you from that episode of St. Elsewhere in the ultrasound scene?
No, Richie, unfortunately. Thank God he didn't. Otherwise, he probably would have went to Alan Bacola. You cast that guy? What? No, I am.
Have you ever told him?
No.
He'll know now.
You may be the only people I've ever told.
Keep it here.
No, I got that. Alan Bacola, the great Alan Bacola, had seen me in that play, The Sum of Us, I had done. And because my wife, Jane, who's a production designer, did a movie with Alan. And so Alan knew her husband. I mean, he sort of knew, he'd seen Ghost and stuff. He was a being loyal friend, came and saw me in the play and left me oh my God, the phone message I got from Alan Bacula made me weep.
Yeah.
It was just so, he was just one of those beautiful people. Like him and Mike Nichols were the two. God. And so Alan asked me to be in the Pelican Brief, so I had the chance to work with him. Yeah. He's really one of the greats of all time.
That was a really great film to work on. Right.
Clute, All the President's Men, Sophie's Choice, produced To Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah. He was just in the most. So I mean, it was great. It's funny looking back on a lot of the earlier films that I did, I don't particularly like my work in them.
Really?
I mean, I think I'm probably, if I watched the Apollo movie, I'd probably go, yeah, it was fine. But it took me a very long time to actually like acting in front of a camera. I liked a lot of what I did in Ghost. I thought that was really good, most of it. The Pelican Brief, I thought was fine. But it was a, it was really the experience of working with Alan.
Yeah.
The role was a little narrow. That role of Fletcher Cole was a little one note, I think. So maybe that's part of why I feel that way. And he was kind of a slightly one-dimensional villain, which is always interesting because you try and bring another side to it, but there wasn't that much to get my teeth into. I guess maybe that's how I feel about it. But yeah, I was thrilled to do it. And I don't know, do I sound neurotic?
I know. I think it's great. No. But every actor goes through the same thing. It doesn't matter if you're really, really successful or mid-range or anything. You all, like you said, you never know where your next job's going to come from.
Yeah, I mean, even like, it's funny now that I mentioned, even like I think back at Scandal, and that was a fabulous experience with amazing actors and wonderful material to work on. And I don't particularly look back on my own work as being great. Some scenes I thought, I loved that. That worked great. But I don't, now that I'm older and more mature, I don't hold that against myself. Like, I don't judge myself. I think this is important to say.
Yeah.
I don't beat myself up. It's just the way it is. You know, I don't, I'll look back on something and go, I didn't really get that. Or I didn't work hard enough on that. Or I was sort of shallow in that scene. Or I know that I was manufacturing it. I wasn't really connected. I was doing it instead of being it, you know, or whatever, though, all the different things that we try to do, aspire to do, that we fall short of. That's 95% is a pretty good batting average. If you can do it 5% of the time where you're like, yeah, for me, that's pretty awesome. I mean, I'm not Marlon Brando. You know, there are some actors who I do think are just geniuses, although they probably don't think so. Yeah. So oh, well, thank you for saying that. I very much appreciate that. And maybe it's important that you always feel like you're not, you know, that always feel like you're aspiring. Meryl Streep always feels that she's, I've heard her say, you know, like, she always feels like she doesn't know what she's doing. You know, I did a play you mentioned with Mamie, her daughter, with Water's Edge.
Yeah.
And Mamie was always telling me, like, my mom just thinks she's terrible. I was like, well, you can tell her from me that she's not. I don't know how I got into this, but I think it's important for actors to know that you don't always need to feel awesome about yourself. You know, we're always aspiring to something that we almost will never achieve. I've learned the same is true of marriage. I've been married for 31 years, and I revere my wife.
Yeah.
But when I relaxed in my marriage was when I was like, oh, it's not supposed to be like that perfect fantasy thing I thought it was supposed to be all the time. It's all complexity, and it's a pain in the ass, and it's you, this is good, and that is bad, and you have to work shit out, and you have to like go, well, wait a minute, what do we want to do here, or what are we doing? And life is just like that. And I think actors so often hold themselves to a standard that's unattainable and then abuse themselves after. I mean, a friend of mine, like, auditioning is this way. You know, a friend of mine in, I don't know if any of you spend time in LA, but the 405 freeway, you know, that actors, you know, after you do an audition, you like spend hours abusing yourself because it didn't go the way you wanted it to go. And like my friend called it the 405 drive of shame. Where, you know, you're like in the car going home and you're like, oh God, if I just done that, oh, I'm so bad. Like, if I could just go back. And, you know, you call your agent and go, is there any way they would see me again? Because I could, I wanted to do this. And she gave me this note and I didn't really take it, but now I know what she meant. And I, you know, all that shit. And it's so unnecessary. And you're not even correct. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm grateful to you for saying that about my work. And I really appreciate that that may be your perception. I'm grateful to you, but I don't, that doesn't need to be my perception of it.
Yeah.
If I fooled you, I'm thrilled. You know? So
let's get into Scandal. Scandal fans, 7 seasons.
Yeah.
Playing the president. That was your first time doing a series, right?
It was. Yeah. I never. Oh, it's for a couple of reasons, which is worth maybe quickly touching on. When I started out, if you worked in television, you were banned from movies. There was a complete divide between TV and film. And in fact, even though I did the illustrious Friday the 13th Part 6 and a couple of other small parts in movies in the 80s, most of my work on camera was as guest star in television shows. And I did a pilot that didn't get picked up. But I was, because of that, known as a TV actor. I couldn't even get auditions for movies. And I had to fight my way in for Ghost. Because Jane, my wife, designed Ghost. And she would, you know, kept saying at the end of the day, they still haven't cast that part. And I'm like, they're never going to see me for that. I can't get it. And I'd call my agents, who at those days, like, didn't even return my phone calls. And but, you know, the assistant, because I called so much, the assistant got me in on that audition. And miraculously, I got the part. It was a total fluke miracle that I got cast in that, and which is a longer story. But once I did that, I could not go back to television. Like, there was for the whole 90s, if I were to do television, you would just be banned. You know, like maybe some HBO movies I did, which was cool. You were allowed to do that. But until the early 2000s, and really with The Sopranos, that changed everything. Actors could not. So I never wanted to do a series because I thought it would hurt my career. By the time it all started changing, I was a director, and if I did a series, if it went, I couldn't direct a movie for 5 or 6 years. And so I didn't want to limit myself by doing a series. Then television became so good that by the time I finished Promises, Promises, and I directed this film Conviction, which, to be quite honest with you, Conviction, right, people were like, oh my God, I remember my agent saying to me when she saw Conviction, oh, this is gonna change the game, like you're gonna get offered so much stuff. And then Conviction didn't do much business at the box office. So I was like, okay. I guess I'm not gonna get offered every movie to direct. And I'd been on Broadway for a year and I was like, I need to make some money, I should not be stupid and I should be open to doing a television series. So I called my agent and said, you know, I want to see what's out there. And I've always said no to series, but let's see what's out there. And then I got a call from Shonda.
A phone call.
You want to be the president? Or she didn't call me. I got a call from my agent saying, Shonda wants to offer you this pilot she's doing to play the president. And then I got a talk with Shonda. And she's like, I don't know what this is going to be. I know you don't want to do a series, but you have other stuff going on. But you could do a few episodes, you could do a lot of episodes, you can be in like part of it, whatever you want. And I was like, well, okay. Let's just see. She said, if you want to do 5 a season, you can do that. She was just so cool about it. And so I think I was, the ABC gave an order of 7 episodes or something, and I was like, they did a 5 out of 7 or something. And then I said yes, and then luck, thank God, I said yes to that. Life sometimes works in mysterious ways.
Yeah. Sharing the screen with Kerry Washington and working on that show, what is that like?
Well, Kerry and I had known each other through politics, really. Not well, but she just had always been enchanting to me as a human being. And then the other thing was, I'd always see films that Kerry was in and be blown away by her and go, who is that actress in that part? Who was that? And wait till the end credits and it was like, that was Kerry Washington? Like, she was so transformational. If you think of her in The Last King of Scotland, or The Dead Girl, or Save the Last Dance, or all some of her earlier films, where she was completely different in all of these films. And I thought, I gotta work with, like, I just was such a huge admirer. So that, when I heard it was Shonda and Kerry, I was like, well, I cannot say no to that. I don't know what this is gonna become, but that's a cool combination. And so working with Kerry was, interesting what I said earlier about Evo and not talking. Kerry and I never talk about stuff. I mean, as people we do. But we would we never talked about the work. We never talked about a scene. We never had to discuss anything. We just kind of did it. And we're always on the same wavelength as actors and didn't want to intellectualize anything. I think partly because our relationship was so much about the chemistry between us, And because I guess initially those characters were so sort of at odds with each other and didn't, I don't know, it just didn't feel right. So we didn't ever talk about it. We just were like, yep, that feels right. Yeah. And so we had this amazing chemistry as actors and became friends through that. But she's incredible. What can I say about Kerry Washington? She's just a monster in the best way. You know, she's an acting, what we call, she's a beast.
Yeah.
If you've not seen American Son,
oh,
get your ass to see that play. Yeah. She's just incredible.
You directed some episodes too.
Yeah, I think I directed 10 or 15. Yeah, did a couple every year. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Challenging to direct when you're in the scenes?
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting challenge. I first did it on The L Word.
Yeah.
That was the first television show I ever directed. And Eileen Chaykin said, I'd like to write a character for you. Would you want to do that? And I was like, sure, let me try it. I'd been afraid to do it in a movie.
Yeah.
Because I thought, directing is so hard. I thought I needed to focus on that. But in television, I was like, what a perfect way to try. Because it's one episode, and if you stink, it's fine. So I did that, and then Dexter. So by the time I had done Scandal, I was pretty familiar with it. And then, but Shonda would, when you get assigned an episode to direct, you never know what the script is going to be, especially on Scandal, because Shonda would turn in the scripts like the day before we shot. So I never knew how much or how little I was going to be in it. And every one, I was like in every scene, with the exception of one or two. And in fact, the first one I directed, Kerry and I had this elaborate sex scene. I was like, thank you, Shonda. So that was interesting. I've told this story before. Kerry says to me. So at that time, this was season two, and we'd done a lot of these sex scenes, and obviously there was all this press, and you know, Scandal was this big hit, and it was all about all the sex in Scandal. That's what people were into. And Fitz and Olivia's relationship was so sexy and steamy and for network television especially. Anyway, Kerry, I love this woman so much. Since I was directing, she's like, Tony, I wanted to, what I do when I direct sex scenes, which I have done a lot, you know, I always want everyone to know what we're gonna do. So I wanna always sit with each actor, quietly, privately talk about my concept for the scene and we want to know what they're comfortable with, and if they're cool, then what story we're telling, and what I imagine physically, and all of it, so that everyone's comfortable when they get to the set, and even to rehearsal. So I said, Kerry, I want to talk you through what I'm thinking, and it was, as I said, an elaborate scene, so she was like, okay, and so we go to the set to talk privately, and she said, Tony, before we do this, I just need you to understand something. I would never say this to you as an actor, but since you're my director, I need you to know this. I hate doing these scenes from the bottom of my soul. I was like, good to know. She said, I love you, but she said, I don't know why at this point in my life. She said, when I was younger, I'd take my clothes off, I didn't care. But now I think it was because she had just, you know, fallen in love and was in a new relationship with her now amazing husband. But she was just not into it. And I got it, and I was like, okay. But here's what we're gonna do. So, you know, then I had to act in it, so every take, I'm like, I'm sorry, we gotta do another one. You know? So that was season two of seven, so I had to get over whatever. I was like, too bad, girlfriend.
I love that. You always return to the theater. You started out in the theater. You did Teresa Rebeck plays. You did Spike Heels. Mm-hmm. You did The Water's Edge with Kate Burton.
Yep.
I mean, and Promises, doing a musical. What was that like? How did that come about?
Yeah, well, I had never done
Tony
a musical.
Tony will now sing.
I had wanted to. Yeah. And I think I'd gotten close over the years to a couple, but I just assumed, honestly, that I couldn't do that. I thought, like, I had a decent voice, but I just wasn't a good enough singer to really do that. And then I got busy doing other things and it just never happened. Then I got offered Promises. And I was like, wow, I'm being offered a Broadway musical? And with Kristen Chenoweth?
Yeah.
You know, and Sean Hayes, I was like, wow, that sounds cool. And it wasn't the lead, it was one of the leads, but it was like I had two or three songs. So it was like perfect. It's like, oh, I can do this and I said to Rob Ashford, who cast me, and I said, look, I would really like to do this, but you need to hear me sing before I do it. Because I don't want to, if I can't. And so I sang, and he was like, dude, you can sing. So you're fine. So I worked hard, and I found actually I really could. Like, I have a great voice teacher who obviously had to really work at it, but it was thrilling because I was like, oh, like directing. So often we just stop ourselves, you know, from doing stuff, and you decide, oh, well, I can't do that. So it always, to me, is nowadays, whenever I think, oh, I couldn't do that, is usually a voice inside of me telling me, well, you better try. As opposed to before, I'd be like, oh, okay, I don't do that. And it's amazing how many people just say, no, I can't do that. Oh, I can't do that. I can't speak in front of people. Or I'm not good at that. People are always saying that to me. Oh, yeah, I just can't do that. I'm like, well, then work on it.
Beautiful, yeah.
You know, we're not good at everything right away. Yeah.
Would you like to do another musical?
I do. I really would love to, yeah.
Is there a favorite role in your canon?
No. I don't know. I don't know. For me, I really would want to do something where it had a lot of substance from an acting perspective. Because a number of musicals, you know, amazing scores, but the books are a little thin.
Yeah.
So I'm working on a musical now that I'm directing. I think I may have told you about this. Please don't write this in the press. But why am I even saying this? This is going out live. I've been developing a reimagining of Pal Joey.
Yes.
With an African-American cast, and that's all I'll say. With my partner, Richard LeGravenes, who's a great screenwriter and television writer. And so it's great. We're super excited about it, but that'll be...
Lisa's hyperventilating.
It's really good. We're casting that now and working...
It stays here. Everything stays in this room.
Yes, I know this is televised. But anyway, so that's something we're working on.
A question from the audience. Your wife is an accomplished production designer. Mm-hmm. You're an accomplished movie director. Do you think you'll work together on something soon?
If she'll have me. I've tried. Jane and I've done commercials together that I've directed, and she's really is brilliant, my wife. I would be very privileged to work with her on a movie, or a television show. You know, it's just when I was starting out as a director, I didn't want her to do my first film because I just couldn't, I needed to figure out for myself, and I couldn't, it would have been bad for our marriage because she was a big time designer and I couldn't have her telling me what to do. You know what I mean? She'd be like, Tony, you're screwing up.
Don't come home tonight.
Then once I'd sort of like gotten my, I don't know, it's just marriage is a funny thing that way, you know? So, but then once I sort of got my feet wet, I wanted her to, but we couldn't, my films were always out of town and someone needed to parent our children when I was doing that. Or if she was away on a movie, you know, we sort of would tag team parenting sometimes. But now that our kids are grown, I would love it. I honestly don't know. It's funny. It makes me laugh. Sometimes I feel like Jane is like, no, I only work with important directors.
I love that.
We'll see how you're doing in your career. No, I'm kidding. But
that's great.
Yeah.
As an actor, is there something you know about yourself now that you wish you knew when you were starting out?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm fine. Relax. It's the thing I talked about before. You don't have to be great. You don't have to... you set the bar high for yourself, but you don't expect to hit it. You just always are aspiring. And I wish I knew that as a young actor. You know, because I knew it last week, and it helps me when I do network. I'm like, I know I'm not going to be 100%. So I go, oh, yeah, that didn't work. Whereas when I was younger, I just tormented myself for years. And it actually got so in my way, I really had to go see a therapist about it in my early 30s because I started hating my work. And I'd done a lot by that point. And I was 35 years old. And I would beat myself up every time I worked. Like after a take, I would go back to my trailer and go, oh, I should have done that. I'd write copious notes about my performance and what I was going to do. Or I'd come off stage and write about how I'd done every, I remember doing a plot, God, and I would like, and analyze my performance all the time. And I, and it was very self-destructive. And the shrink I went to see was like, yeah, you know, you're afraid to work because you know you're gonna kick your own ass as soon as you leave the set. And that's not okay, you know? So learning to be okay with falling on your face and that was just, it's a very hard lesson to learn. And it's not about being good. It's not about everyone liking you. It's not about, you know, I don't read reviews because I can't, I still am too sensitive to read them. But it doesn't matter if they like me or don't like me. Honestly, it doesn't matter. I'm not quite mature enough to be able to read a bad review and go, I don't care. Or read a good review and not feel like, wow, they like that. Yeah. That was good. You know, I've still, my ego's, I haven't yet detached enough, but I know it does not matter. So I wish I could help myself with that as my younger self. I would have enjoyed work and progressed faster as an artist.
Yeah. You know, when I was going through, I mean, there's so many questions, but you've worked with so many incredible directors. I mean, Tom Hanks, mm-hmm. Ed Zwick. I mean, what was it like working, like, Tom called you to do the project on HBO, right?
Yeah, Tom asked me to play Neil Armstrong. He was so sweet. In From Earth to the Moon, which is where I met Bryan Cranston.
See?
Bryan played, it was a brilliant miniseries that Tom and Ron Howard produced for HBO 20 years ago about the Apollo space program. And Bryan played Buzz Aldrin and I played Neil Armstrong. And it was wonderful. Yeah, that was great. And Frank Marshall directed two episodes. And Frank Marshall directed the one about Apollo 11. And then Tom directed one about the Gemini program another great actor, Brett Cullen, I don't know if you know Brett, played Dave Carpenter in one of Neil Armstrong's earlier missions, Gemini 2. Anyway, yeah, but I've worked with a lot of great directors.
And you've learned Oliver a lot Stone. From these gentlemen. Oliver Stone.
Yeah, he's...
That was the Nixon cool movie you did
Nixon,
with
yeah.
Anthony Hopkins.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But what a genius. Yeah. I was so inspired by him. And he really, you know, not... Again, he could be rough, man, but some other time, I really was so inspired by him. I wish I had the chance to work with him again. I've worked with a lot of great directors. Too many to name all of them.
But you've learned so much that's gone into your work as a director, hasn't it? Or some of it?
Yeah. Sorry, that's a complicated question.
Yeah.
I felt like... Yes, people like Oliver, yes. Different things. Oliver was, the thing I learned from him is you better bring your ideas and a strong point of view to what you're doing, much like Ivo van Hove, who's nicer than Oliver, but, you know, or don't come to work. Do not wait for me to tell you what to do. You better bring it and bring a strong point of view. And I feel that way about auditions. You know, that was what I learned from him. He really responded to that. And I did that for him. And other actors who were like, well, I don't know, what do you want? He would just beat the shit out of them. It was terrifying. Mainly, you know, Ed Zwick, such a great director. Ed, you know, different things. You know, the way Ed told a story, when we did The Last Samurai, the battle scenes, the way Ed was able to take something so complex technically and always tell the emotional storyline, that's what was important. Mostly what I learned from bad or mediocre directors. In other words, as an actor, things that directors did that shut me down or did not help me. So when I did A Walk on the Moon, I remember saying, I don't know what I'm doing, so I'll just try to be the director I've always wanted myself. And what that meant to me was someone who gave you a safe, collaborative work environment, space to work in, that was not judgmental and was like, what do you think? Like, what's your idea? Help me make this better. Like, what do you want to, and you know, that collaborative thing, which is what actors thrive on. And also being positive with actors as opposed to judgy and negative. You know, like, there's a lot of directors who don't understand actors. They're like, no, that's not, don't do that. Don't do that. Why are you doing that? And they might be dead right. Like, we had on Scandal, one of our really good directors was our DP, Oliver Boekelberg, who's a brilliant DP. But Oliver was a first-time director on Scandal, and he's a brilliant guy, and he was always right. But he's very German, and when first Oliver started directing, he'd go, don't do what you're doing with your hands. Don't do that with your hands. Why are you moving your hands? No, just don't. Why are you doing that? Like, wait, what am I doing, Oliver? Why don't you just tell me what you would like? What would be good? He's like, oh, okay. You know, but normal, you know, often directors do that. You know, and it can shut you down.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to shut an actor down by being negative, especially a less experienced or a more fragile actor. So you can take someone who has great gifts and shut them down immediately. And it's the same thing with any creative artist, whether it's a cinematographer or a camera operator or someone, you know. So I enfranchise people. So with a camera operator, for example, I'll say, here's what's important about this scene. You know, this is what is so important. So if you find it, like, you do what you think. This is what I have in mind. I'm thinking the shot might go like this, but you do what, because you're the expert. And you say that to people, and they're like, oh, thanks. You know, then they'll die for you.
Yeah.
Because you're giving them, you're respecting their creative process. So I kind of learned that by directors that didn't do that. Even though I've worked with many wonderful directors who also do that. But unfortunately, I feel as a director, I learned more from less good directors.
Yeah, sure. Another question. You've directed really fun romances, comedy, some heavy drama. Is there a genre of film or TV you'd like to get into that you haven't done yet?
Yeah, you know, to me, it's all about the story and what inspires me, but I would love to do a film on a bigger canvas. You know, most of the films that I've directed are smaller character pieces, so it would be really amazing to do a big period piece or something that had, you know, was much more technically ambitious. I've done a lot of that kind of thing on television, frankly, now with a much bigger scope. But to do a feature film that had a lot more scope than the ones that I've done, I would love to do that.
Would you like to return to TV after network?
Oh yeah, I will. I will. And I, you know, Richard, as I mentioned, Richard LeRoy, yeah. I have a company with our partner Cheryl Black, and so we're developing a lot of material that we're hopefully going to have up and running. But you know, be series that I would do. None of what we're doing, I would really just produce and direct those. We're trying to find a vehicle for me to act in, but I'm looking. Yeah, I would love to act in a show.
Again. After playing Max.
Also Chambers I'm doing. But you'll
we're going to talk about Chambers.
In April.
After playing Max for the past month, what have you learned about yourself?
That I need better vocal technique? No, honestly, I was thinking about that today. You know, I have quite good... I went to drama school, man. I've done a lot, but I'm struggling vocally with Max. It's very high intensity vocally, this show, and Max has some very explosive moments vocally, which I think are important to be that. And yet I'm hurting my voice a little bit the past couple of weeks, so I realized my vocal technique is not as good. My speech is pretty good. Is very good. I think I really have good speech technique that I learned in drama school, really at Lambda, which is. And I have good vocal theory. But maybe because I haven't been on stage for lengths of time for a while, you know, I tend in explosive moments to hurt my voice, and I got to figure that out because. We have a voice and speech coach, Kate Wilson, who worked on the show, and I was thinking I got to call Kate and find out what I'm doing wrong. Because like on Sunday afternoon when I went home, I was like, and that opening night was rough, man, because we'd opened it, and then we had to go into all this press. And when I talk to you, you know, like they work us to death, so you're talking and party and loud, and so I've learned that about myself.
Okay. That's big. That's great.
Yeah.
Chambers, let's just talk about that's your latest project with Uma Thurman, right? Mm-hmm. Netflix?
Yeah, it's a new series on Netflix. Uma and I play husband and wife. Really the protagonist is a 16-year-old girl who is a Native American girl who has a heart attack and gets a heart transplant. And she's, you know, a poor Native American girl, and she's saved by a heart transplant from a 16-year-old girl who died, who was a wealthy white kid. And this is set in Arizona, and Uma and I play the parents of the girl who died, and we want to have a relationship with this young woman, and we want to sort of bring her into our lives, and we offer her a scholarship, and we live in this rich community, and she's from a poor community, and we kind of, you know, give her this scholarship at this fancy private school, and she's like, whoa, you know, and she starts to have these crazy associations with the dead girl. And so it becomes kind of this supernatural thriller slash family drama slash high school drama, like, you know, like 13 Reasons Why a little bit. It's enough, but it's also more grown up than that. Another, not that that's not grown up, but it's not just for that audience. So it's quite interesting. A really wonderful writer named Leah Rachel created it, and we'll see.
Can't wait. Yeah. My final question is, what is the best bit of advice that you've been given, either personally or professionally?
The best advice I've ever been given, which people who've heard me talk before, because I
that
say it all
by.
The time. When I was 19 at Brandeis, not getting cast, thinking, what the hell am I doing? My brother-in-law was a famous jazz musician named Gary Burton, who is really one of the greats. And Gary... we were at brunch or something, and I was like, oh, I don't know. How do you know if you can do it or not? And he said, Tony, when I was 19, I felt exactly the same way you did. And he said, I was from Indiana. I was from a little town in Indiana. He was a child prodigy at the Vibes, is what Gary plays. But he didn't, you know, he said, I came to New York at 19 with no idea if I could actually be a professional musician. And he said, I said to myself, I know that if I give 100%, if I commit 100% to what I'm passionate, this passion of mine, either I will end up doing that, or I will end up doing something else that I don't even know about yet, or I don't remember if there was a third option. Oh no, yeah, the third option was, but if I don't give 100%. I'll be the guy who at 40, 50 years old looked back and said, gee, maybe I could have done that. Maybe I could have tried, but I was too scared to do it. And he said, you don't want to be that guy. So I was like, okay, thank you, Gary. So I said to myself, okay, I'm going to commit 100% until I see a different path. And that saw me through a lot of hard times. Because for, you know, and even hard times after success, when I suddenly was struggling again, you know, and things weren't going the way that I wanted, right? I have a failure, you know, that hurt a lot, you know. I would just be like, well, I made a commitment to do this, so I'm just going to keep doing it until I get the impulse to do something else. You know, like directing was something else that took me into another path, or maybe it would have been teaching. I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't been cast in Ghost at 29, or look at Bryan Cranston. You know, when I worked with Bryan, he was 42 or 44 when we did From Earth to the Moon. And Bryan had been, you know, a working actor, but I would say struggling, you know. Mm-hmm. He was Dr. Tim in Seinfeld. Yeah. So people thought he was a really good actor. And I guess Brian Ward, he'd been on a soap and he'd done stuff, but I know when we did From Earth to the Moon, he was thrilled to get that part. He was actually recast. Someone else was cast and was fired. And they brought Brian at the last minute. And I didn't know him. And as we were working together, as I got to know him, I was like, this guy's a genius. He was like the funniest person I'd ever met, and his mind worked in this crazy way that I thought was so unique. And I said to myself, wow, man, look, somebody could be working at 40 in their mid-40s, early to mid-40s, and nobody knows how great. And he'd like been got a small part in Saving Private Ryan, I remember. He just worked with Spielberg, and he had like one small scene, and he was, you know, but so things were going okay for him, but he wasn't, no one knew him really. And yet then a couple of years later, he got Malcolm in the Middle. Yeah. And I remember seeing that going, see? Because he was so brilliant in that show, and it was such a great vehicle for him. And then, of course, Walter White changed television history, you know. It was a testament to, you know, Brian was just focused and committed. to what he loved. And he still is exactly, that's the thing that, like I said at the beginning of the conversation, you just feel that's what drives him every performance. He's 100%, man, just because he's so committed. That was the best advice I ever got.
Beautiful. Well, I want to thank you. This was a masterclass this afternoon. I mean, what an insightful.
Oh,
you were so honest about the art, the craft of acting, directing, producing, just being a human, trying to work your way through this career.
Thanks,
you have eight shows to do this week. I wanted to have you here for the longest time. If you haven't seen him in Network, you must go see him in Network. Thank you, Tony Goldwyn.
Thank you. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you for listening to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. If you appreciated what you heard, please support us with a review or donation and reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA Found. We'd love to hear from you.